Can everyone hear me? Welcome. Has everyone had a great week? I know some people over there have. You guys had an awesome time this week? Yeah? Good. Thank you for coming out to our session. We're gonna dive down into some really cool stuff today. But first, I think, let's introduce ourselves. You go first.
I'm Elaine Van Bergen. I'm an architect in OBS down in Melbourne. I'm a SharePoint MVP and MCM, and help run the SharePoint user group down there as well.
My name is Garth Luke. I'm Vice President of Sales for AvePoint, based in California. Also GM for AvePoint Australia. Very, very cool to be out here and really enjoyed the conference so far and got a lot out of it. So what we're going to do is, our topic is a kind of an interesting one. Elaine and I have had a lot of fun preparing to share some stuff with you, and we're gonna go through a lot of deep dive technical stuff, but we're also gonna talk about some of the real world examples that we've seen out there that can maybe be valuable to you guys in your journey through SharePoint. But really focusing today on how to scale ECM on SharePoint 2010, and let's kick off from there.
So some of the key things that we're going to run through, basically an overview of some of the ways and the scale points within SharePoint 2010. We're also going to run through the architecture and concepts, some of the different features that you can use in different ECM situations, and basically things that you need to think about as you're going to scale. The key takeaways that we want you to get from this session is you're going to have to put a lot of planning into your SharePoint installation if you're going to scale up to a large ECM solution. Often it's also not obvious up front when you're going to scale to that size. So really with any of your SharePoint solutions, you should take some of these considerations into your planning. And also we need to understand that it takes a big team to do these large SharePoint installations. You know, there's some great things that have come out from Microsoft. For example, the SP1 has allowed us, to go up to databases of 4 terabytes in situations where we want to do collaboration. However, there's a lot of big caveats in that, and we'll talk about some of those and how you go about planning and making sure that you take them into consideration.
Cool. So we're gonna start right at the beginning. So let's actually do a show in the room. Who is running SharePoint 2001? That's great. 2003. Wow. 2007. 2010. That's pretty impressive. So that's a good reflection of what we're seeing out there in the market is. It's very interesting to see how, and it's actually kind of comes down to Windows 7 as well. We're seeing a lot of people have moved to SharePoint 2010 and very, very early, which is very encouraging. It says Microsoft's actually getting stuff really, really right this time around. So I'm going to talk to you about growing with SharePoint. And before we start getting into some of the technical elements, just the journey that we see most people taking over the last 10 years, and some people obviously embarking and starting on their journey now. Firstly, you see people starting off, using SharePoint as a content repository. And I always like to tell a story of my meeting with Siemens in Germany about 6 months, a year ago, sitting down with them and talking to them about their strategy, about how they're using SharePoint and what their plans are. And a very, very interesting organization in terms of what they're using SharePoint for. I mean, you see 4 elements here, which are kind of some of the common ones. But these guys are really, they have 400,000 employees, and they're using SharePoint for everything, including ordering their lunch every day. So that's kind of an interesting story. But Microsoft sat down with them about 4 or 5 years ago and said, well, look, there's this thing called SharePoint, and we just want to check with you if you're using SharePoint internally. And they said, look, we don't use SharePoint. It's not part of our strategy. It's not what we're looking to use. We might look at it at some stage, but right now we're not using it. So Microsoft went in and did an audit on their network and found 455 SharePoint farms. So an example of being in a position where, us as a business, we don't really use it what content is sitting in those farms? Who has access to it? What sort of risks are we exposed to from a recovery point of view? There's a whole lot of these things to consider, but that's really where their journey began, and probably most of you, where content repository, I've got stuff in SharePoint, and that's where the journey begins. And from there on, you start thinking, well, let's put that all into a central location and start collaborating on that. So put a hand or show who's using SharePoint for collaboration. who's building line of business applications on SharePoint. It's pretty healthy. And full ECM on SharePoint, anyone? Okay. That's pretty common, right? Is that what you see, Lane?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we're looking at, this is the journey you travel, collaboration, start building line of business applications. Maybe some, you know, some may have some developers internally that are starting to build stuff for your organization that really makes sense to the business. And then talking to what we're talking about today, really going and doing something full on ECM on SharePoint 2010. And you can see as you get more value out of SharePoint, it gets more complicated. So then you start out with no information architecture and you potentially look to deploy an information architecture strategy. From there on, you go and do some form of migration where you consolidate and maybe from legacy systems into SharePoint. And you start facing things like looking at performance and cost, and we're going to talk through some of the technical details around that today as well. And then you maybe even, you know, as an internal IT organization, whether you're a physical organization or just an IT team in an organization, you are essentially offering SharePoint as a service to the business. So SharePoint implementation journey. So we start off with scaling. So we look at infrastructure. We look at load balancing potentially because you've got having to look at how many concurrent users you're running. You then migrate. You know, you centralize the content like we said. Doing collaboration, looking to enhance your search capabilities. We're going to dive into that more as well. And then from a protection perspective, you know, you have SLAs to the business. How do you meet those? You need to look at potential corrupt data and your disaster recovery strategy. And then moving on to management, managing your users and your permissions and your data growth and all this sort of stuff that you got going along as well. So just talking about, we're going to start talking about some of the scalability from an architecture perspective. So Elaine, maybe you can just talk through how, you know, your recommendation around, you know, moving from dev all the way through to production. What is your experience and what have you seen out of the market?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk to a lot of customers and we start talking about what kind of environments they have. And they tell us, you know, yeah, we've got a production environment. I think Garth had a great statement on this before where he was saying that, and then we find out what they're doing in their production environment, and that's where they're deploying their code to for the first time. That's where they're making changes. So then we go back to them and say, no, actually, you've got a test environment. You don't have production. It's very important as we start getting to these large-scale solutions that you actually apply governance down to your other environments. Particularly with staging, you need to make sure that that's equivalent to your production environment as much as you can. You know, sometimes we do have hardware constraints, so maybe you might have 5 web front ends in production. You might not need 5 in staging if you can't afford that, but you want to have at least 2 or 3 so you're simulating that load balancing experience. Things like if you've got fast search deployed in production, you're obviously going to need that in staging as well. And as you go through and plan that, that can actually mean that you need a significant amount of storage in these other environments as well. Things like indexing and storing of content. It's no good if you're testing all that off, you know, 100 gigabytes of data and you've got a terabyte in production. You're just not going to get the same experience. So what we do is we work through with a lot of customers and work out how they're going to get their development environment set up, get their customizations deployed in a repeatable way, so it's packaged, it's scripted, and then we can move through these different environments from development to testing to staging and get it into production into a repeatable manner.
Yeah, and it's really about building a production line, really. I mean, you start off on I've got some customers that have 6 farms. They've got dev, you know, testing, QA, you know, user acceptance testing is an additional environment. They've got a training environment where they use to do some change management process for their users. Obviously, production, and there's some more stuff that you can do on there as well. But essentially, we're saying, you know, the scaling of these environments and your staging environments really brings stability to your long-term strategy around ECM.
Okay, we're now going to talk through some of the different scale points you have in different ECM scenarios. And as we go through different scenarios, you'll notice there's different numbers of instances. So as we're looking at those team sites, the collaboration sort of scenarios, we have a lot of them typically in any environment. Then we move up to a more managed library where there's a clear owner, there's metadata, there's some kind of taxonomy set up and perhaps an approval process for content that gets published. Typically, there'll be a few less of those in your traditional collaboration scenario. Then we're moving up even into the tens of the millions of documents sitting in a knowledge base or document repository. Very strong ownership of these, and you might only have a few, if multiple at all, within an organisation. And then we move up to the massive distributed archive, something like a true records management scenario, where a lot of the content might be read-only, perhaps. You're only going to typically have one of those in most instances. And what we're going to talk about is how some of the features that you have in SharePoint, are like the enterprise management features and content types, with a new 2010 functionality, can tie all these team sites together and basically create a story for your content to move through those different layers from your team sites right down to your records management scenarios, if that's your desire. So the first one we're going to talk about is the ad hoc team library. Now, note it says library. This might be in a site by itself, but it might just be a library. One of the things I see a lot when I go and do audits on SharePoint environments is these sites where there's team sites for all these different people, and the only thing that's used in them is one single library. Everything else is just, you know, a waste of space, basically. And you have to kind of ask, why did you provision a site to start with? They only need a library. So, you know, keep that in mind. You don't necessarily have to give everyone a team site just because they need to collaborate. Now, this is where most SharePoint installations start. So people just start loading content in and sharing it, you know, ad hoc with their peers and their colleagues across the organisation. And generally, we're not talking about a lot of documents. A couple of hundred documents, not really much scale to worry about. However, as you start adding these guys up, it's almost that death by a thousand cuts, right? 1 year down the track, you have 100, you know, 2 years, you've got thousands, millions, and moving on up. And all of a sudden, you've got this massive amount of content that you don't know who owns, and it's all old and out of date, and it's just taking up your storage space. So when we're looking at this ad hoc team library level, it's really important that you put some governance around it. Garth, have you seen any common sort of governance things people should put around ad hoc libraries?
Yeah, well, I kind of, the word governance is a funny term because I've been talking to a lot of the MVPs around and having some interesting conversations, and governance has been kind of, you know, put into a little box over here, and that's what governance is. And I really believe that governance is something that actually touches everything. It's not just about, you know, some of these ad hoc team libraries. It's not about how you manage your permissions or how you manage your metadata or how you do those different elements of SharePoint. It really touches everything. So from when you start your journey, when you start looking at migration, you know, what's the governance you're applying to that? I was talking to Mr. Brian Farnhill over there about, he's like, oh, governance, you know, governance isn't something I do. And I'm like, well, mate, you're a developer, right? So there must be some governance around how you go about deploying code. You know, how do you deploy from test to dev to production? You know, so there's a lot to be really thinking about from a governance perspective as to how that covers you from the hardware layer all the way up to the business and what the business user's needs are.
Yeah, and as we said, these things can scale very rapidly. So you end up with lots of these ad hoc team libraries or ad hoc team sites. With SharePoint 2010 now, we can really break the site collection boundaries. So we can pass metadata through to those multiple sites. And we can push content types down. So if you are going to have a lot of this, you're not locked down into that single architecture you used to be with SharePoint 2007.
Let me ask you a question, Lane. What is the biggest content database that you've actually seen out there?
Oh, putting me on the spot.
I bet you mine's bigger than yours.
Yeah, I bet you. In Australia, we don't usually see over a couple of hundred gig in most instances because, I don't know, maybe Australians are a bit smarter than Americans actually, like, read what it
I'm
says,
not American,
you know,
so that's
follow
all
the
good.
Guidelines.
The biggest one I've seen out there is actually a terabyte, which is pretty interesting. Yeah, so it's very important to start considering some of these things because when you start getting to that size, it's really difficult to manage and scale.
Yeah, so now we move up to the next scale point. So we're looking at really hundreds or thousands of documents. And this is where we're starting to have a managed library. A managed library really typically has some kind of internal owner. So this makes these guys a little bit easier because you do know who owns the content and who's responsible for making sure it's up to date. Here we typically look at applying things like a structured taxonomy using the managed metadata features, which we'll have a look at in a minute. And ideally, you know, what we used to do in 2007 when it first came out is everyone hated folders. All of a sudden we loved metadata. And people went a bit overboard and they started asking users to fill in, you know, 20, 30 items of metadata when they uploaded a document. Pretty rapidly they found that didn't work. What we find is even 5 pieces of metadata, if you ask a user to do that, that's a lot of work to actually get them to type something in. So the key feature of these libraries, because we know what they're used for, who they're being used by, we can default most of that metadata. The end user just dumps the document in and it's stamped with all that information just for free. You can still ask them for additional bits and pieces if you need, but the important things are stamped on there already for the users.
One of the things that I find interesting, Elaine, actually is and talking about uploading documents into SharePoint, and if you're a guy or a lady who is putting content into SharePoint and it has the ability to understand the APIs that are available, you'll note that Word documents sometimes have 12 standard metadata fields and sometimes more, which are actually most of them empty. So you find when you start loading these documents into SharePoint, not only are they take, if you've got thousands and thousands, are taking a long time to get them into SharePoint because you're absorbing metadata fields which are actually blank. But on a long-term basis, that adds to your overhead as well. And the thing that I find very interesting, and Elaine and I have talked about this a bit, is when it comes to arranging your taxonomies, I cannot tell you how performance is hit if that's not thought out very thoroughly. So looking at the managed library scenario here, you need to really understand how to architect your information architecture strategy to be able to deliver that performance to your users. And we're doing some interesting projects actually on the mobile side where an organization wants to share managed libraries to end users in the field through some tablet applications, and the performance that they see in the drop in performance when it's not architected in a really thought out manner is really, really bad. So,
and I think one of the hard things there is also designing in what's going to happen in the future, right? I've talked to multiple people here during the TechEd conference who said things to me like, oh look, we spent all this time designing our content hierarchy and we had this great information architecture all around our departments, for example. But guess what? Every 6 months we change our departments, so how do we deal with that? Right? So you have to really take into consideration some of those factors. If you think certain areas are going to change, well, you don't actually need to have a physical hierarchy by department. It'd be actually better to have that as a flexible metadata field and use your navigation, have it driven off the metadata of the document. So if you have three departments today and you end up with 10, or your departments merge, well, the managed metadata service can deal with merging of terms and adding new terms very well. Whereas a traditional folder-based hierarchy will really struggle with that kind of concept. Now we're moving up into the scale point of a big repository or a archive. Now, SharePoint 2010, we can do millions to tens of millions of documents in a single repository. Now, that definitely is possible, but we're starting to get into the territory here where you really need to start planning and working out how you're going to deal with your performance. Absolutely, we've got customers that are doing this, and totally possible, but they put a lot of planning into it. It's not just an ad hoc thing that grows this way.
And I think it's important to understand, like you're talking about the planning and the strategizing around it, is there are very, very many things to be considered when actually building this architecture. And a lot of it has to do with, what resources you've got on the hardware side, how much RAM are you throwing at your machines, how many web fronts you have, how many concurrent users you have at the same time. You really need to think these things out, because if you don't understand those metrics, when it comes to planning these things, you're going to make some very bad decisions that you're going to be stuck with for a long time.
Yep, absolutely. One of the key points is as you start getting to these big repositories, it can be a bit daunting for users even to work out where a document goes. So that's where a feature called the content organizer can come in there. Essentially a drop library. The user drops a document into a particular place, picks some metadata on it, whether that's the content type or various, metadata fields, and based on that, you then route it to the appropriate location and actually tell the user where that location is. And that can make it a lot easier for them to just put a document in one place and have it go through rather than having to worry about saving it to a particular location. And we also have to start looking at, as we get into these big archives, how do actually people find information? There's no point putting all this information in SharePoint if no one can get it back out the other end. So as we're starting to talk about these millions and tens of millions of documents, we also have to look at our search technology. People like me, I don't use navigation. If you look at my computer, I have like maybe 5 favorites in my browser. I just dump everything into the search engine, and that's how I find anything that I want.
So what happens if you're Microsoft and you get onto their internal portal and you search for the word SharePoint? Tell us about those.
Yeah, I mean, they have about 50 million items that come up. But the good thing is they're actually using FAST for their search technology. And as well as telling me there's 50 million items, it gives me a whole bunch of automatic refiners. So I can then go and start drilling down and doing things like, I want to know, you know, things that were authored in the last 6 months or maybe just in the last week, or things that have this particular piece of metadata, which might be SharePoint 2010 or it might be ECM. And as I then narrow down, you know, I can pick whether it's a Word document or a PowerPoint I'm looking for and get that experience of drilling down through those 50 million items to actually find the ones that are relevant to me. And then we're moving up into the really big end of town, massive distributed archive, hundreds of millions of documents, and there are customers in Australia who actually are using hundreds of millions of documents in SharePoint, which, you know, 5 years ago people would have said that's pretty impossible, but yeah, it's definitely being done. But we're doing it with big distributed architecture. So most of these scenarios, there's multiple farms involved. Fast search is definitely a requirement here. And we're pushing out those content types to ensure that across all those multiple farms and environments, we still have a central set of metadata and a central set of functionality that's common for all the information that's being put into the system. Also very important, obviously some kind of archiving procedure on here. You know, obviously there's legal requirements. You might need to keep things for 7 years, but you really want to make sure that if you don't need to keep things for legal requirements after, you know, after it's past its useful lifespan, that you've got something in there that'll archive it off or at least push it down to cheaper storage so that you can, you know, save on your cost.
So sometimes we talk about why migration, you know, doesn't always make sense, and we're going to start talking about, you know, how this sort of scenario can impact your plans over a long-term basis. So I'm going to talk, you're starting year one, and this is really scaled along that first slide I had with the steps. You know, you start off with a migration and you put stuff in SharePoint, and the interesting part about that is there's a segment of content which is stale. You may go through a refining process to cut down on the content you're migrating, but you're going to find that there's still going to be content in there which is not touched as actively as the other content. And as you grow, that just gets worse exponentially. So talking about archiving, this is a great scenario where you need to start understanding, have a way of understanding, you know, which content is being touched regularly and which is not, and have a way of being able to tear out that storage and moving it down the cost of storage to make sure you're getting your good ROI out of your SharePoint infrastructure.
Yep.
And that's often tied to things like, you know, your SLAs. You know, you might be in a position where even that content which is stale content needs to be available. So you've got to find a way of building an archiving strategy which is actually going to help you get access to that content, but at the same time get maximum performance out of your hardware.
And even considering things, right? Like, lots of people say, hey, let's put our entire file share in SharePoint day one. Woo, let's go. Really, what's the use of that? If you're not going to provide any additional value by tagging things with metadata and it's content that people are infrequently accessing, you're probably only increasing your cost. Have a look at some of the technologies that you've got. You can still index all that content from SharePoint. Maybe set it to read-only and have people pull in the content as they start editing and collaborating on it. Or look at some of the other offerings from, you know, the vendors to sit on top of file shares and make them appear like they're in SharePoint without having to go through the effort of pushing it in and out through SharePoint. So there's lots of different considerations there. And definitely, as we said, this stuff's complicated. Don't pick an entire file share migration as your day one project.
I think a big part of ECM from my perspective, Elaine, is that you know, I really believe that in order to scale it effectively, storage is really where it's at. You know, you're going to grow in, you know, we have a customer we're working with at the moment in Holland, talking of an international example. The customer is actually Shell, and we're working with T-Systems in Germany doing a very long-term four-year migration project. 400 terabytes of content. So far we've done about 70 terabytes year one, another 3 years to go. But you can see what I mean when you're in that sort of scenario. I mean, you're in a lot of trouble if you haven't got something figured out in terms of how to take care of all that content. Scaling is going to be a big issue for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Elaine's going to do a bit of a demo for us. We don't want to do dev by PowerPoint, so Elaine's going to show us some cool stuff.
Okay, so I just thought we'd flick through some of the ECM features and have a look at how they're configured and how they can be used in some of these scenarios. So we're going to start, you know, in Central Admin, because this is a technical session, and have a look just at the Managed Metadata service. So generally what we look at is this is a service where you store your taxonomy, your metadata terms. And if we have a look at some of the properties we've got available, down the bottom here you'll notice that they have a content type hub associated per Managed Metadata service. We'll actually have a look at how that works. If we then have a look at the proxy, there's a number of key options here. So you can have multiple Managed Metadata services, and as we scale up into large scenarios, we typically look at having multiple services here. The first tick box here is very important, where it talks about being the default storage location for keywords. Within SharePoint 2010, there's a great feature where you can go through and you can tag documents with informal taxonomy and put your keywords in there. If you've got hundreds of thousands of users, that becomes very, very chatty, and you're going to want to put that into your separate Managed Metadata service and have that as a default storage location for keywords and keep your formal taxonomy completely isolated. Okay, so let's jump over into the Term Store Management tool. This is where we define our taxonomy terms, and within here we've got multiple options, so we can have different administrators. Typically, you know, the SharePoint admin is not going to be the term store administrator. They don't want to know about what your taxonomy terms are. That should be someone from the business really owning these term items. So we expand on out. It's very easy to go through and create different terms, and you can see here we've actually got a hierarchical kind of setup here, where we can have term sets, terms, and multiple layers of hierarchy below a term. Now, you do have some limitations with different versions of Office. You really want to be on Office 2010 if you're going to use some of these hierarchical term sets. But if your SOE is in order, it's definitely a good sort of feature to look at. And as we go down through these different term sets and terms, you can see each of these can also have things like an owner. And we can define a submission policy. So can people, you know, add ad hoc terms into these levels? Or is it a closed term set defined by the organisation? We can then also go through and actually start combining and merging terms as well. So, you know, as I said earlier, it's very difficult to get this stuff right and have one term set that'll last you for one year even, let alone 2, 5 or 10. So you'll see down here we have some options. For example, we could merge this term with another, and that will actually push all the metadata associated with those documents together. We could move it to a different place in the hierarchy, or we can actually reuse this term, which is another good option because sometimes you might have multiple hierarchies with the same terms in them, so you reuse it across. If we have a look now, we'll have a look across at the content type hub. So one of the big problems we had with SharePoint 2007 was you could define content types, but they were very blocked in at the site collection boundary. As we start getting up into these big scenarios, we've got to have multiple site collections. In fact, we're potentially going to have multiple farms. But, you know, you want to have this level of content type consistency. So if we look here, we've actually got my content type hub. And on this site, I have defined a, you know, basic content type. We'll just go through and we'll actually add an additional site column to that. I'm just going to have a single line of text for this one. Put it on in. Because this is defined in the content type hub, you'll see I now have this additional option, managing publishing for this content type. So what I can do is I can make as many changes as I like to the content type in the content type hub. Then I come through here and I push the republish, and that's me indicating this is now ready to be pushed down to any subscriber of this content type. If I go to a site which is a subscriber, down on here we can see that I actually have my department test content type down here. It won't have received that field yet because actually it's a scheduled process to push it on down. So what I need to do is actually, we're just going to, you know, fake it for the demo. We'll kick off our content type publishing job, and we'll let that run, and hopefully that'll come on down for us. We can also see down on this site that basically we can, you know, if something's gone a little bit wrong with the content types that it's subscribing to, and we can see down here that it is subscribing to that hub, and that we've got the particular content type coming down, we can actually pick that we want to refresh, and then it will pick up all those changes to the content type and push it down. And we also have a log file. So if we were receiving errors for some reason with publishing the content type down, we could then click on through to the content type publishing error log, and that will give us some indications on those errors. Now, one of the very key points that we have to be careful here is that you really need feature parity between the content type hub and any of the sites that you're pushing down information to. So if, for example, you wanted to push a content type down from the hub that had a particular custom field on it, you'd need that defined down at all the sites. If you wanted to use the document ID, again, you need that feature defined down at all the different sites that are picking up metadata. So let's see if we've given it enough time. We'll let it wake up. And hopefully we will have pushed our field down. It wouldn't be a SharePoint demo without a loading screen. Hasn't quite come down yet, so we'll check back in on that later. Also, while we're looking through, we'll have a look at the Manage Metadata columns. They're very nice and easy to add. If we add them in, we can pick Manage Metadata and select on through, and then we can see that it's actually showing us the term store that we looked at earlier, and we can pick which level we want to pick the Manage Metadata field to hook up to. So in this case, I might hook it up to Department. Or I could pick it up to one of the sub-hierarchies. We can also customise the term set. So you can have individual term sets defined per site collection, for example, which is a very nice feature. One of the other things we talked about is actually how do you get down and start finding all this information and even creating this information as you're starting to talk about large archives. So one of the good features for this is the metadata navigation, which you can see down here on the left. So what I've got is a bunch of content in here with various metadata fields, and on this library I've turned on the navigation. You can see I can now drill down based on metadata and pick particular documents, and it will automatically filter all the content on the right-hand side. And I've still also got my, you know, common folder view. Also in here we've got the concept of a document set. So what we can do now is we can pick our Manage Metadata fields here, so I can go through and I can browse for it, select on through, or I could just type and it will auto-select. Go through, and the idea of a document set is a group of related documents. So what it has gone through there and done is it's defined all these documents based on three templates that I'd specified in my content type, loaded them up with a naming convention, and stamped them with the metadata that I selected at the start. From a browsing point of view, it appears very much like a folder with a different icon, so I can just go on down. When you saw that things being created at that level, you notice that I had to put in which department I'm from. But I have my finance folder here, where of course we know what department that's for. And you can see I've set some defaults of metadata here, so when this form popped up, it automatically filled in that finance field. And as an end user, I didn't really have to think about that at all. So if you have a look at how that's set up, the defaulting of metadata is through these column default value settings. So I can go in here and browse down through my folder hierarchy, and if I pick finance, when it loads up, we'll actually see that's being defaulted to a particular value, and I can click on any of these and then choose a different default value based on its folder location. Really nice and easy then for the users to drop in content and have it auto-stamped. Also, you saw the metadata navigation. They were those fields down the left-hand side that automatically showed the tree view. These are selectable. You basically go through and configure your metadata navigation hierarchies, and also which ones you want to be filters down the bottom. Automatically, it will start managing your indexes for this list. As you start getting into these really large content repositories, you'll actually have to turn that off and you'll have to look at manually creating some of these indexes. And that's when you obviously really need to put a bit of planning into that situation. The great thing about this metadata navigation, which is a site-level feature, is if you actually turn this on and you have more than 5,000 items in your list, normally end users will start seeing nothing and SharePoint will start returning an error. Once you have metadata navigation turned on, instead it'll give users the best amount of results it could. So it'll do what's called a fallback query and return, you know, maybe 100, maybe 200 items, whatever it can get based on the indexes that it'll find. Okay, the next thing I just wanted to talk about very briefly is that drop-off library concept. So here we've got a drop-off library. I can go up and I'll add a document. And you can see right here when I went to add a document, it's warning me, documents uploaded will be automatically moved to the correct library. So if I pick one of my test documents and upload it here, it's processing it through. I put my metadata in. As soon as I load it in, it then processes it and gives me back the URL where it has automatically moved that document to. And I can click on that and it will be in that department documents library. So that's just gone down here. And you can see that I've got a versioning scheme set up where it's actually added some unique characters to make sure it didn't overwrite the document that was already there. So if we have a look at how that's actually set up, under our site settings, we have content organizer settings. So basically, we can turn it on. We can allow it to push to another site. So really good for those distributed archives we're talking about, where users just submit always to the drop library in a particular location high up in the hierarchy. And then we use the content organizer to push across to different site collections and different content libraries. We can have it create subfolders. So maybe, you know, every 5,000 items or every 2,000 items, we want to create a different folder format for it based on particular metadata. And what sort of versioning we want to use as well, and whether or not we want to keep the audit records when we push it across. And if we look at the rules, this is where the really important logic is. We set up rules basically as to how it's going to pick which bit of content gets pushed across to where. And there's multiple ways we can do this. So, for example, you might pick, in this case, I picked anything of a particular content type of department will automatically get pushed across to that particular department document library. But you can get quite specific and have a very big hierarchy of rules. So based on different bits of metadata, you might want to push it to different locations. Based on, you know, almost any property of that document, we can pick it on through.
Another reason that's really important is from an archiving perspective, if your metadata tags are set correctly and your content types, you can actually be archiving way more intelligently and understand what category of documents need to be archived off from a logical perspective based on that content as well.
Well, rather than watching the load screen, I think we'll flick on back to the slides. Okay, so some of the really important things that we've changed as moving across from 2007 to 2010 is they've put a lot of improvements into the actual database. Not that you'd ever touch the SharePoint database, of course, but if you were to look at some of the schema, you'd notice that there's actually been some significant changes between 2007 and 2010 to allow them to start getting to these larger scales. Also, some of the ways it's accessed has changed a lot. Because there's very large tables in these databases, and they have to be very careful as to not cause things like table locks when accessing various pieces of information. Also, there's a lot more work that's been done around the indexing and the automatic performance tuning that happens on SharePoint. You've got to be very careful with SQL DBAs if they start going and poking around in SharePoint. They'll often want to do all this cool stuff, you know, around defragmenting and adding their own indexes and switching things around. That can be a complete nightmare. I've seen that completely wreck the performance of multiple SharePoint installations. Yes, there are certain things that you need to watch, and there's great white papers on, you know, how you tell if you do have database fragmentation. But by and large, the indexing and all those kind of things are now taken care of with inbuilt rules within SharePoint. So in the majority of the situations, you really don't want your DBA sitting in there and flicking around with different settings. They've also improved some of the remote blob storage features, which we'll talk about a little more. And a lot of the tasks which used to be high load have now become background item processing tasks. So for example, if you delete a site, it's not really gone for, you know, at least about an hour after you hit the delete. What it does is it removes the reference, so it no longer shows up in navigation and those kind of things. And a background processing task will then go through and perform that higher load task of actually deleting all the content from the database and making sure that it's all cleaned out. And not only does that help your performance, but it also helps the reliability, because, you know, those of you that are on 2007 might have seen certain situations where that delete didn't quite complete. You know, it hit a load spike and you ended up with orphaned content and had to clean that out with particular commands. Now that it's all done by background processing, it can occur over a much longer period of time and be done in a more reliable and repeatable way to ensure it does get cleaned out thoroughly.
So looking at the 2010 Service Pack 1 improvements, obviously the Microsoft's finally released some metrics around some of these things, which is really important, so you can scale correctly. But obviously larger databases are now supported. We'll talk a bit more about that. There never before was it was actually quite interesting, during the release cycle of, we're on the TAP program for SHIP in 2010, and during the release cycle, I think the second item changed 3 or 4 times. There was going to be a site bin, and then there wasn't, and then there was, and then there wasn't, and then they released it and didn't have one. So they've added that now to Service Pack 1, where there's a site recycle bin, which is really great as well. And then obviously from a storage manager perspective, there's some changes there. And then SQL file stream RBS support. So obviously there's been support for that previously, but they've made some enhancements to that too. We'll talk in detail through that. So now we're going to talk through SHIP 2010 architecture. The first little section we want to talk about is, you know, there's some new metrics around, obviously the limitations around content database size for 2007 was around the 90 gigabyte mark. Like we talked about earlier, I've seen some customers that have up to 900 gigabyte content databases, which is very scary, and some crazy amounts of versioning. I've seen up to 1,000 versions per document, which blows my mind. So those are some of the things you can think about there. So collaboration sites and content databases, you're looking at the 200 gigabytes sort of space, and we're going to talk in more detail about the details, the limitations on the high end. So you move to larger content databases. Microsoft have said, and if you read the documentation very carefully, it says 200 gigabyte to 4 terabytes. Now, 4 terabytes is a pretty frightening number. We've seen some interesting deployments of that size, but you want to really understand that's not just a number that gets plugged into a content database. There's a lot of architecture that gets done to make that make sense for you. And then obviously looking to archiving the sites off, I mean, because that content is not accessed as frequently, I would say performance is less of a concern there. Talking about collaboration to archive, do you want to talk through that?
So, you know, one of the things that I think when we're talking about these large-scale databases, if you don't have a team that's going to sit there and have a look at managing your performance and you're going to do a real serious job of this, don't go over that 200 figure. Keep in that kind of area. As you start getting up, you know, to those 200, even the 4 terabytes, there is a lot you have to think about. Unfortunately, the majority of the customers I've dealt with only read the bit of the white paper that says you can do it. And they don't read all the caveats that say, well, you can do it, but you're going to need a third-party tool to back the thing up. And you've got to think about how long 4 terabytes is going to take to restore. And you're going to need this crazy SQL hardware to do this. So, you know, really think about how that structure is actually going to work with your team and the skill sets that you've got. And also, you know, how you're going to manage that moving forward.
Actually, I'd add to that. I mean, the four terabyte, you know, reading the first page is quite scary, because, you know, some customers will read that and they will go and try and implement that as it is read, and start to find out very, very quickly that it's something that's, you know, you probably want to keep it down to a more manageable size. It can be done, but like Elaine says, it's really, you've got to really think about it a lot harder.
Yeah, so one of the things you can look at doing to keep down to those smaller database sizes is how you actually move your content round through its content lifecycle. So, for example, those collaboration sites we showed earlier, typically you have lots of them and they're very small. Well, they could be in multiple site collections, And multiple site collections can mean multiple content databases. So then, rather than managing really massive content databases, we're actually looking at managing a number of different smaller databases. Then as that content becomes, you know, something that you actually want to have managed in a document management sense, we're pushing it across, whether that's using something like the content organizer to get it into the correct location.
Yeah.
The beauty of using things like Content Organizer is, as we saw, the user just sends a document to a single location. Then SharePoint will route it to the appropriate place. And again, that can give you the ability to do things like have multiple content databases for that big repository, and you don't have to worry about those additional scale concerns. I'm also looking at how you might use search as well to provide that navigation experience across all these multiple site collections. And then typically you look at using things like information management policies and various things to push things across into the records centre. As you get to the records management approach, typically it's not so hard in terms of your backup scenario because the assumption is that records don't change very rapidly. So you do have to look at backup fairly carefully though, because while you might only need to back it up once a day, for example, because it's a big, large chunk of content, you have to make sure that you actually have that running in line with things like your disposal policies. If, for example, you restored yesterday's database and you had records in there that should have been disposed by this point in time, having them come back by that database record, by that database restore, will actually make you non-compliant to most records management sort of situations that you're applying to. So even though with a record centre you're potentially backing up less frequently, there's things that you have to take into account to make sure that you are meeting any of those legislative requirements of records management.
And you take the scenario and put RBS on the back of it, and then you've got also more concerns to worry about from a backup perspective as well.
So as we get up to these big data storage architectures, we actually start have to think about our SQL Server storage and how we're actually going to partition that out. So one of the first things that we look at doing is potentially segregating off the disk of SQL Server. So something, for example, that's very high throughput, very I/O intensive, like your temp database, you'll actually look at having that on different disk to your content databases. We also ideally look at grouping like workloads together. So something like collaboration, lots of documents going in and out all the time, versus records management, which is a much more static kind of archive where things go in there at a scheduled point in time. You look at segregating them out to different SQL disks. And in many situations, we actually have multiple SQL instances in here for these different features, so that you can scale up to those, you know, multi-terabyte sort of scenarios. Also, if you're looking at going above that 200 gigabyte mark for a content database, that's where we start looking at partitioning a single data file into partitioning a database into multiple data files. With a lot of these things, though, we have to be quite careful, because if you partition it off too much and you don't have the right number of processes on your SQL box, you're actually going to run into almost as many performance problems as if you didn't partition it in the first place. So essentially, with a lot of this SQL Server sort of technology, as you scale things up and out, you need a lot of testing in there, because it's not really one of these rules of thumbs where people can go and, oh, yes, yeah, customer B has exactly the same hardware you've got and exactly the same disk and the same network topology. Because every customer has various different things in their scenarios, you really have to look at doing your I/O testing up front to make sure that you can meet whatever needs you're aiming to.
And that often ties into your, for the infrastructure guys out there, ties into your RAID configuration as well. So obviously RAID 10 is something you want to look at for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, the amount of input-output speed you can get is going to be dependent on your hardware layer, so your storage layer. So make sure your storage vendor who you choose is one that you trust and one that you understand before you go and implement it.
Yeah, it's really going to that point we said earlier where you actually need a whole team to plan this stuff. You know, your typical SharePoint consultant is not going to necessarily be an expert in moving around disk at the SQL level or working out, you know, with the SAN vendor how it should be configured up. They might be able to provide guidelines and help you with the testing from a SharePoint point of view, but you really do need lined up experts in each of these areas and have them working together to achieve your performance goals.
I'd love to be running RAID 10 in my home net. I've got 10 terabytes on my network at home, and it would be really awesome to have RAID 10 running, but it's just too expensive. So we're going to look at multiple, basically farms sharing services. And one of the things that SharePoint 2010 has really added to its scalability is, and how it ties into ECM, is service farms. Previously in 2007, you obviously would have your service functionality running inside the same farm. You're now in a situation where you can actually have farm A and farm B and be sharing services between farms, and gives you another layer of redundancy as well. And what have you seen out there with service farms, Elaine? Have you seen any interesting configurations that you want to share?
Oh, I've seen plenty of interesting configurations, absolutely.
Many.
Look, it is really important, particularly if you're looking at geo-disperse situations, that you look at how chatty your shared services are going to be and which ones are supported and which ones aren't going to be supported. Something, for example, like the user profile service should really always be running on a local farm. You shouldn't look at sharing that out. It's so tied in with all the other various features of SharePoint that if you try to share it through a services farm, you're going to end up with a performance problem on a lot of your different features. Things like managed metadata, though, is a really good option, you know, where you actually want to push out your managed metadata information and have that across your multiple farms. Something we talked about earlier, though, was around our different environments like dev, test, staging and production. In 2007, a really common scenario was to stage a whole website that was about to go live by doing that on the staging farm, picking up the entire content database, attaching it to production, and away we go, everything's live. When you start getting into these shared farms and even just using service apps altogether, you have to think about how that architecture works. If you're actually picking up your content, which was attached to a particular set of terms and a managed metadata service in test, and trying to attach it to production, all of a sudden it's going to fall apart because it's lost that connection with its shared service provider. So what you can actually look at doing instead in that scenario where you want to have the same managed metadata in your staging as your production environment is you can use this shared services farm architecture to do that. It's a very common situation we hit now with many customers actually sharing things like the managed metadata service from production down to their staging farm so that they can actually stage all their content and push it on through.
It really gives you the ability to stand up farms and shut down farms very easily depending on what services you're sharing. And in the instance where you may want to rebuild a farm, it means you don't have to take down all services. You can actually do it in isolation, which is kind of cool. So we're running out of time a little bit. We're going to shoot through the RBS overview. Anyone know what RBS is? Put your hand up.
Wow, they're still awake.
Yay. So it's introduced in SharePoint 2010. It's obviously the previous version was for 2007 was actually relevant to SharePoint, which is EBS, External Blob Storage API. And that's been sort of replaced by RBS. For SharePoint, which is more relevant to SQL. So it's a standardized APIs, and it basically allows you to externalize your blob stores. Okay, and built by the SQL team is really giving you the ability to now take your SharePoint implementation to that next ECM level. It enables, in terms of bulk data, to offload that to cheaper forms of storage, which Elaine talked about earlier. And really one of the big things that I see with customers and what's holding them back, I remember a conversation with BMW, also in Germany actually, they're a big Documentum shop, and I just said Documentum, I don't think I was supposed to, just kidding. But massive Documentum, and I'm talking millions and millions and millions of documents these guys have got, and I actually said to them, well, you own all the licenses, guys, why are you not using SharePoint? They said, well, look, to be honest with you, storage is just too expensive for us, we just can't afford to do it. So this is RBS scenario is really going to take that to another level. There are some great third-party solutions out there that can help you deal with that. We're going to talk about some of the native ones. But firstly, to talk about, just going to go through the basics, what a blob is, a Word document, any real document, that's what a blob is. Binary large object, it's basically a file. And then what is stored in SharePoint? So you've got your metadata, which is now attached to that file or that blob. And then you take your content database, and this is essentially what it looks like. Now, the interesting part about, I always like to tell this scenario because I kind of think it's funny, and we were talking about some interesting Excel, people still running things in Excel other databases. But, one of the interesting things is if you take the scenario of an Excel spreadsheet, and you take a 1 meg file and you paste it into every cell and do it a million times. That's what you're doing to SQL. Now, SQL is a transactional database. It isn't built to deal with blobs. In fact, no database is built to accommodate the storage of blobs.
Yeah, so with RBS, we have a couple of different options. We've got the local file stream option, which is basically pushing out those blobs to storage that is actually attached to the SQL server. In most scenarios, that doesn't really make sense. There's not really a lot of benefit from doing that. So typically, we're looking at using the remote file stream sort of functionality. We're actually looking at pushing things out to various different tiers of storage around the organisation based on the different sort of settings that you want to set up for this.
Interesting part, before you go onto the slide, and the interesting thing that I would say every customer I talk to at the moment, storage is their number one priority. It's the thing that is talked about. You know, if I go out and meet customers, it's the one thing that they talk about more than anything else is how to scale their storage. So the ECM platform and how to build that on SharePoint, the underlying mechanisms of storage and how that's architected, I would say that's probably the biggest priority in terms of being able to scale effectively.
Now, what we saw earlier in one of the slides is that RBS is actually built on, you know, technology provided by the SQL Server team. So it really is sort of a standard technology. But unfortunately, the providers that Microsoft has pushed out are quite basic in terms of their functionality. As we start getting into these ECM scenarios and getting a lot of data in there, you know, ideally you want a lot of flexibility. And that's where you start looking at one of the multiple third parties that provide RBS providers. That with those, you get a lot of additional flexibility. Some of the things like maybe you want to externalize your content to the cloud, you know. Got to have the buzzword in there, of course.
Yeah, cloud's got to be there.
Yeah, got to mention in every session. Maybe you want to have a look at, pushing things out to various different storage devices. Or even looking at older versions of SharePoint or different versions of SQL. You'll get a lot more flexibility with many of the third-party providers.
And compression encryption is actually something that's interesting. I get asked that a lot, and obviously FileStream doesn't give you the ability to do that. So with some of the larger deployments we see out there, compression and encryption, when you're externalizing using RBS for them, is very, very high importance to them. And then talking about things like, you know, we're talking about backup, and synchronous backup is something that FileStream, unfortunately, doesn't give you the ability to do. Looking at backing up content database independently of the blob store as well, or item-level, platform-level recovery. Restoring without DB staging, something you can't do. You can see it's pretty much, unfortunately, and I know they are trying to make enhancements, but unfortunately the file stream misses the back on, when it comes to ECM, I would say, is very limited. And then we're going to talk about some myths. Let's talk about the myths. So basically, no SQL license is needed. Well, clearly you need SQL to run SharePoint, so you're going to need that. RBS allows me to store data in the cloud. Well, RBS is an API, so unfortunately that's not true. RBS allows for much larger document storage. RBS always improves SharePoint performance. Now, I've got always in capitals because most times it does, but there are circumstances when it doesn't.
Yeah, it goes back to that testing scenario we talked about. Much like SQL and, you know, your SQL Server architecture, you have to test your RBS architecture as well to make sure whatever scenarios you're using it in, it actually is going to increase your performance.
Yeah, and generally you're looking at metrics of any file. If you've got files bigger than a meg, you should be looking to externalize them most often. What tends to happen from a performance perspective is, as soon as you have files that are bigger, you think, oh, well, you know, it's just going to affect the upload of the file, when I'm viewing it. But actually you don't realize that the performance that you're drawing to read that file affects everything else as well. So you need to understand, you know, what type of content, you know, from an ECM perspective, to actually know what content you've got stored. To say, oh, we've got 2 terabytes, doesn't really mean anything. You need to understand the category of information and how to deal with that on a from a storage perspective.
Yeah, for example, 2 terabytes of, you know, 1 megabyte files might be very different to 2 terabytes of, you know, 50 to 100 megabyte files. Very, very fundamental different scenarios there that you might deal with quite differently.
And the last one is RBS doesn't require synchronous backup of SharePoint and externalized blobs. I mean, absolutely, that is an absolute must. If you're looking to do this, you need to understand if the change is made on both sides and your backups are not being done at the exactly within a couple of probably seconds of each other, there's going to be some orphan stubs you're going to have to deal with in a recovery scenario.
Yeah, and if you're looking at things like records management, backup needs to be your key, you know, consideration there. Because again, you're relying on this as your records archive, and if you're not backing this up in a synchronous manner, you could be really throwing out all your compliance. We're saying that you must. You actually want to make sure, depending on which provider you're doing, you want to make sure that it's synchronous when it's doing that.
Yeah, it does. But see, but you've got to understand something, right? This is a longer conversation. Backing up SharePoint is way more than just SQL. There's a lot more to be considered, right? So when you're doing a backup of your SharePoint, the SharePoint side of things and the actual RBS store, a lot of things to be concerning. We've got a slide to talk through that as well. We're going to get into fast. We've got probably 5 minutes before we need to.
Okay, so one of the things we talked about earlier is there's no point putting a bunch of SharePoint content in there if nobody can get it out. Typically, as we look at large amounts of content, we're going to put fast in there. Fast can scale to millions and millions of documents and gives you a very effective search. You can get nice, fast search times and very high queries per second with the fast architecture. However, fast requires quite serious architecture to do this. In most cases, you don't want to be running fast on virtual. It uses so much CPU, network utilization, and memory that in most cases, physical is going to work best for you in that scenario. If you do want to go virtual, typically we look at special configuration, where if we're going to do millions of documents for indexing, we're actually going to have to dial back fast indexing and slow it right down, so that it's indexing very slowly to not use up all your resources. Also, we're talking about lots of machines. So SharePoint, you know, lots of users come to us and they've seen a nice demo of SharePoint and they see that fast search page and it's got document preview and they say, wow, I want those fancy document pictures. Can you just turn fast on, please? Fast is not something you just turn on. It's a whole separate farm that essentially you're going to build and you're going to manage. It's a serious bit of functionality. Obviously, this is a very large example. We're trying to do millions and millions of documents here. But it is a whole separate undertaking that you really need to get in there, perform the planning, perform the testing that we've talked about with the other features. So you can definitely scale fast out. It'll scale up probably as big as you need to for any Australian scenarios. But think about what you're going to do, both from a memory and CPU and network performance point of view, but also about storage as well. As we're looking at indexing large amounts of content, you're also going to create very large indexes. There are some situations where, depending on how many different ways you're indexing that content, your index file might even end up being bigger than the content that you're indexing. So really think about and do some testing on that content that you're indexing and see how big it's going to be before you go too far with rolling out this kind of big scenario.
And we generally recommend to our customers to implement fast when they're kind of above the 1.5 to 2 terabyte mark. As soon as you start getting that to that size, depending on what type of content, you're into the millions of documents already. So just looking at some scalability considerations, and we're going to fly through this. We've got to cut probably 3 or 4 slides left before we move on. This is the slide I was talking about just now. This is really what we consider to be a complete SharePoint backup. So you can see there's the content side and the content database and the search index, etc., is not just the one thing that needs to be considered when actually building your backup and recovery strategy. There's your customizations and your SharePoint configurations. And we talked about the external blobs. There's that to consider, system configurations, and there's the whole stack there to help you understand, you know, when you're building your recovery strategy, you know, what is it that you need to be thinking about? And that's it. That's really, I think, a really good illustration of what to be thinking about when you're doing that.
Yeah, and often when we get into those very large scenarios, you know, we talked about those databases that are 4 terabytes. Trying to restore something like that from a SQL backup is just going to be unfathomable. So really we're starting to look at these really high sort of backup and recovery requirements where potentially you might have a hot standby farm sitting there with all your content actually replicating across. Again, there's a lot of configuration that has to be going into that kind of scenario because of all these different pieces. Lots of things you'll have to get pushed across to that hot standby farm if you're going to want to flick across to it at a moment's notice. We talked a little bit about SQL before. SQL, basically, you really have to look at the performance of your disk. It's very, very critical you get this right. There are some good tools you can use for this. SQL.io and the SPDiag tool have some information in there. Ideally, you want to get someone in that specialises in this area. And one of the tricks is also to try to play out quite a realistic scenario. You know, so try to pick a mix of different user activities. If you can, if you've got SharePoint 2007, you can pull some data around how people are actually using your current system, and you can play that against your 2010 proposed farm. That gives you a really good idea as to whether or not what you're going to do on 2010 will perform better than 2007. And then you can use things like Visual Studio Ultimate with the load testing tools in there to ramp up and do extra performance testing on top of that while you're monitoring what's happening at the disk sub-level as well.
And touching back on the RBS scenario, you know, one of the things you need to remember as well is it's not just about you know, the upload of documents and what time that takes, but at the end of the day, I/O is really what it's about. It's not that it's, you know, when you search for a document, it's not taking a lot of time to find the document and find where it is. It's really when you start to try and extract that to view it, where you're getting your big hit on in terms of I/O performance.
Yeah. So other things that you have to think about is Garth talked a little bit before about some of those properties inside Word and how they get promoted up. Things like the Record Center, for example, because that's dealing with so many document properties, it actually turns off property promotion, so it can just suck that document in very quickly. And it's something that you might want to consider whether that works in your initial data load design. Maybe you want to turn off some of those features, get your data in there, and turn it back on. Also, SQL Server. Again, if you've just done the next install, it has terrible, terrible defaults when it comes to SharePoint. You'll see things like it'll start trying to grow the database by 1 meg at a time. So basically, every single document you're loading into SharePoint is causing all those databases, not only the temp database, but your content databases to grow in size and fragment across your disk.
And obviously from a SQL resourcing allocation perspective, if you don't set your resourcing on SQL, it will by default probably try to use all the resources you have available on that machine. So that's also going to affect performance in a very serious way.
Yep. And there's a number of different features you've got to look at as well. While we showed some things like the managed metadata service and the content type hub that works really well across multiple site collections, not all SharePoint features are like that. So something like the document ID service is really designed to only work at the site collection level. It's not guaranteed to be unique across multiple site collections and across multiple farms. So in those big scenarios, you're going to have to do some customization to get that to work.
Yeah. You got through the key takeaways. I'll let you wrap that up.
All right. So we've given you a whole bunch of information here. Really, the key things we want you to remember is that usability and planning are very, very important in these scenarios. You've got to plan these things, you've got to test them, and make sure you do that at the hardware level as well. Think about some of these big architectural considerations when scaling up SharePoint. Things like, does RBS suit you? Are you going to have a multiple farms, shared services farms? At what point are you going to break out to different SQL databases for your content? And that this is not going to be something that you have a SharePoint architect sit down and just plan the whole thing out. You're going to need your storage vendor involved. You're going to need potentially third-party tools. You're going to need your SharePoint guy talking to SQL experts as well.
And if I can say one thing there, don't segment yourself from the business. To make this successful, you need to understand what the requirements are. I see a lot of teams that operate in isolation and don't really try and understand what the business is trying to achieve. But at the end of the day, it's the technology that's gonna deliver that functionality that the business needs to put on from a functionality point of view on top of SharePoint. So we've got some more information here for you here. You can have a look at the slides. They'll be online for you to download. Some really useful links that we put there on scalability and multi-terabyte databases and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I don't think we really have time for question and answer. The keynote is starting in...
Yeah, people can come find us.
So please come find us. You're welcome to come chat to us. We'd love to talk to you. Appreciate your time. Thank you.